Did you see that fleet of trucks headed for the post office just before midnight? They were carrying Mayor Bloomberg's tax returns. No, I'm just kidding. But WNYC's Bob Hennelly is laughing here to talk about a certain tax loophole that he noticed on the billionaire mayor's tax disclosure form, a perfectly legal one, we should say up front, plus the mayor standing his ground on the gun laws in the Trayvon Martin case and weighing in on the Bush tax cuts in general. He thinks they should be abolished not just for the top 1%, but for you. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Yeah, I just what we know about the mayor's taxes are that he was asked right around the time that Romney's disclosure came out that showed he paid a relatively low effective tax rate, and he was able to take advantage of some legal, you know, carried interest in the rest and get a very beneficial tax rate. The mayor said at that point he believes he pays the highest rate, but again, when the New York Times asked him in a Q&A, didn't give any specifics. He said when you account for the charitable giving he gives, he believes he pays the highest rate, but we didn't get a number out of him. He does give some $330 million out a year, you know, as charitable giving. But what we do know about the Bloomberg Enterprise, and that he owns about 89% of the Bloomberg LP media empire, which includes the data machines, which provide all this innovative information in real time so you can do trading. The value of that company, and that's the bulk of his wealth, has gone from like under $5 billion when he came into office. Forbes estimates it's around $22 billion now. The company confirms around a $7 billion revenue flow. So all we really know is what his city disclosure form that every elected official has to put out there that lists subsidiaries. What we do see is that when he came in, there were like 49 subsidiaries. Now there's 89. And in that list includes two in Bermuda, two the Isle of Jersey, which is off of Britain, and one in the Cayman Island LLCs. And I asked him specifically about the Cayman Island LLC subsidiary.
Most of this country is middle class. And that's where most of the tax revenue is.
Oh, so okay. All right. Hang on. So we're going to get Bloomberg. Okay. This is in response to your question.
Right, so yeah, I asked him about to give me an explanation for why that appeared on his disclosure form.
All the president has to do
is say, that's not the one either. Well.
Okay. See where it says Bloomberg on Cayman? Let's try that. See if this turns out to be the right cut. Let's go to Trump.
Companies typically would have and in a lot of parts of the world, you have to be registered to do business in that country. We have reporters in 120 countries. I don't know about the Cayman Islands, quite honestly. I don't run the company. It's been a long time since I've been there. But we would have subsidiaries in most of those 120 countries, or at least in the 60 cities, because you have to be registered. It doesn't have anything to do with taxes. Sometimes local entities have taxes. You pay them. But in any case, all the earnings come back here, and Americans pay taxes no matter where the money is made.
Now, it's important to know that Bloomberg LP put out a statement when asked about this, saying that all U.S. income goes through primarily New York City, New York State, which are high-tax jurisdictions. But what this raises into question is the phenomena we've seen now since the 1913 tax code was put into place of the ability of global wealth to use and take advantage of some 40 different tax havens, Brian, around the world that will offer you and are begging for your money to be parked there. So as a result, we've seen general accounting offices documented this. Professor Sachs from Columbia has talked about it. We now have some $2 trillion that's stranded overseas that multinationals have parked there from their profits because here in the United States, the effective tax rate for them is 35%, and they feel that's too high. In the past, during the Bush administration, we had a tax holiday where we dropped the rate, and that money came back in. But scholars say generally that that just reinforced multinationals' bad behavior. So now the mayor has entered into the fray. You know, the Buffett rule, we've talked about that while at a Wall Street Journal breakfast. The mayor said that he was kind of spoke out against this idea of corporations being able to manipulate it this way. And he said that in order to be more competitive, the U.S. had to lower its corporate tax rate, try to bring that money home, get it to work in the country, and raise taxes on individuals, hence what you were talking about before about getting rid of the Bush tax cuts.
Is this part of a race to the bottom among countries competing with each other for capital by lowering taxes lower than the next guy?
This raises a central question about how we fund the public sphere. And Professor Sachs' work on this, his breakthrough, The Price of Civilization, talks about it. Dylan Radigan's talked to some degree about this implication that all of a sudden money can go anywhere. So in the balance between capital and labor, capital is holding all the cards now. So they can say, for instance, to Greece, we don't like your social contract. We think you have too many public employees. If you don't comport with what we want in the way of austerity, we're going to dump your currency and dump your bonds.
By the way, tomorrow we're going to get another view on this on the show. We're going to have Mitt Romney's economic advisor, Glenn Hubbard, one of his economics advisors,
great,
who happens to be the dean of the business school at Columbia University, or maybe he left that post to work on the campaign. I'm not sure. But Glenn Hubbard, who's definitely in the Bush administration and is now advising Romney, has a different view about a lot of these tax questions, and he will be here tomorrow. You have another clip of the mayor in response to you about why he won't disclose his taxes and amount he paid?
It's important to know that the mayor does go an extra step. There's an annual ritual where we reporters are called up to his accountant's office, Geller & Company, and we get to see a redacted version of his income tax form. He doesn't have to do that. It's important also to know that no U.S. citizen, including the president, has to disclose their income tax. This is voluntarily done. There are federal employee and candidate disclosure forms about conflict of interest. That's different than what is ultimately a personal document, your income tax. In the version that reporters look at, you see where there should be numbers. It's A through G. And these are numerical values. So G represents $500,000 or more. And pretty much everything on his form that's redacted is a G. So it doesn't really give us a sense. So I asked him why he doesn't disclose what he pays in taxes.
There's no reason to. We have categories, and I have a personal life. The accountants will tell you I pay 100% of my taxes. I don't have tax shelters in the context that you would talk about it. I pay what I'm supposed to pay, and we earn money all around the world.
So he wouldn't consider that Cayman Islands and Jersey Island and et cetera stuff tax shelters?
No, this is advocates of these kinds of structures say that this is the way that you create a free market, innovative investment opportunities, and it's an efficient way to move money around the world. That's the way to build wealth. There's nothing illegal about that. The bottom line, though, is that in 1913, these structures were not facilitated by the internet, which has really changed the dynamic of this. So, and here's the other thing. Right now we're in a situation with, why is it that Bloomberg LP and all these other global enterprises, Microsoft or the rest, why can they do so well? And what? Because there's a stable world. What's making that stable world? U.S. military force projection. The degree to which we are not taxing that corporate wealth, that multinational global wealth, means that they're kind of shirking, quite frankly, and leaving to the average American in business, poor, rich, or whatever, the burden of paying for that military. It's important to know that this is in the environment. We saw David Brooks report that by 2022, the U.S. will spend $915 billion on interest alone, Brian, because of our inability to reconcile this dysfunctional tax system.
You know what? We have a caller from the Cayman Islands.
Okay.
Adam in the Cayman Islands. You're on. Can I go to Adam here on line two? Sorry, I'm having a little problem with this line. And maybe I can't go to Adam. So we'll go to Joe. No, now we can go to Adam in the Cayman Islands. Hi, Adam. Thank you for calling in.
Hello. How are you?
Good. So you're listening to us talk about your home.
Yes. I've called before, too, from here.
I remember.
I'm listening on iTunes radio. So since I've lived here about 2.5 years, I'm from Los Angeles originally. I've been trying to figure out, like, well, so what's the deal with this place? It's like, it's so vilified as this tax haven. And I was thinking about it in the context of Mitt Romney, too, because he got kind of lambasted in the press about it. I'm no Mitt Romney lover. But the way I understand it is you get a tax break if you open a company here, and you have to do that with a Caymanian citizen, like a partner, you then would have a tax-free company. So like Mitt Romney, for instance, had investments, and some of them were made through companies here, like through brokerages or whatever that are companies here. Now, those brokerages or the people who have companies here, they get a benefit from being here. But when he cashed in any of his investments, if they're in the Cayman Islands or Mars, it's U.S. income, and he paid taxes on it. So I'm still struggling with this. I'm still not 100% sure, like, well, where's
Well, let's go into it. That's very, and I think we need a correspondent in the Cayman Islands. I think that's a great idea.
Okay.
One of the things is that there's a number of practices, and again, this has nothing to do with Michael Bloomberg, but one of the ones that Professor Sachs has brought into relief, and so has the General Accounting Office, Senator Carl Levin from Michigan, is a concept called transfer pricing. Are you familiar with that, transfer pricing?
No.
Okay, transfer pricing is a way that, like, a drug company has something super-duper that's great. It makes it here in the United States, and so then it licenses it. It creates a subsidiary in the Cayman Islands or Bermuda and says that, in essence, that subsidiary owns this wonderful invention. And so every time that they make any kind of profit on it here or anywhere in the world, they pay a licensing fee to that subsidiary, which is just coincidentally very close to the profit that they've made on that item, thus turning a profit on the U.S. tax form into a liability. So that's how you can have large multinationals with record profits, according to Professor Sachs, paying their lowest percentage into the U.S. Treasury. So that's just one, and that's one example. I mean, your analysis is accurate, but I'm just offering this other thing, and there's a dozen more. One of the problems is that, just like we saw with the derivatives and we saw with the best minds of our generation when it came to financial things, who should have been doing, like, building space rockets or doing science and engineering, they worked on complex risk issues, right? We've seen the same thing with business minds turning to tax policy. And so, unfortunately, right now, business planning starts with a tax strategy. And so we have a tremendous complexity that works in all these various ways where, for instance, we have legal fictions. How many corporations that are domiciled here in New York, you think, are actually domiciled in Delaware? There are some advocates that say that states lose $49 billion a year because of the legal fiction that they're able to say, yes, we do business here, but they're actually in a cyber file somewhere in Delaware.
Because Delaware has laxer
Well, not lax, but it's like,
tax
well,
laws.
If you talk to a journalist like John Stossel, because they're more efficient. You can have a corporation so much easier. You can do drive-by online corporation formation. But also there are tax advantages depending on the strategy you're using.
Adam, was there anything else you wanted to say?
Yeah, well, you bring up legal fiction. So how can you, like Obama and a lot of people, want to stop these offshore investments and what you're talking about? But can you stop the Cayman Islands or other places without stopping Delaware? You know, is there a way to parse that out? And because they sound like two sides of the same coin.
Right. And that's a good point.
Great question.
Yeah, because you have some experts in Washington who say that Delaware is the Cayman Islands of the United States. Or you pick your state where they that's where you have credit card companies located in these places. One of the things you have to look at here is one thing that has increased is transparency. It is true since 9/11 that tax havens in general do have to disclose more to the IRS. And let's make an important distinction here. There's something called tax avoidance and tax planning, totally legal. Then there's something called tax evasion. That is illegal. That is where you deliberately try to conceal income overseas. Now, the Obama administration, what they've done is had three amnesties, Brian, for people that have been doing the evasion part, and it's already netted the U.S. Treasury $4.5 billion.
Wow. We're talking about mostly Mayor Bloomberg and what he was doing and thinking about on tax day. Adam, thank you very much for calling in from the Cayman Islands. Our Bob Henley is here. The mayor spoke out yesterday about the Bush tax cuts as people were filing their returns. And, of course, these tax cuts will expire at the end of this year unless Congress acts affirmatively to extend them. And they will expire for everyone, not just the 1%. And that seems to be what the mayor favors.
Most of this country is middle class, and that's where most of the tax revenue is. So if you want to raise $4 trillion over the next 10 years, which gets you halfway, only halfway to a balanced budget, everybody's taxes have to go up.
Why is the mayor weighing in on national tax policy like that? And that's not Romney's position. He would keep the Bush tax cuts for everybody. It's not Obama's position.
Right.
He would keep the Bush tax cuts for everyone except the top few percent.
Right. I think it's important to go back to historical perspective. In 1913, the first year that the income tax was imposed, it was targeted at the 7% top earners, and $500,000 was the threshold. And then historically, we've seen it go as high, like in the 1950s, at 91%. And then it's gone historically, according to the Tax Policy Center, in 2012 to 30%. 35%. And so that's for the top 1%. It's also important to understand we've been doing a lot of things with tax policy that is not all reactionary. Let's consider the earned income tax credit. There was a great piece in the Times about this. One in five filers gets this credit. That is money they get back from the government. That's not their paying taxes. They're getting money from the government. That's 28 million households are getting this additional money. They're the low-wage end workers. This is in place since the 1970s, and the Center on Budget Priorities estimates that this has pulled 6 million Americans out of poverty. So the tax code's doing a lot of things. One of the problems is that our tax code has not kept up with the way we do business. That's really the problem. So much of what's happening here in the United States in terms of profit and activity is permitted to be abstracted as if it's occurring somewhere else. We have a similar problem on a local level with the question of the internet being, for some reason, tax-free. We don't want to have tax on the internet. It was revealed. We're not going to tax the internet. This creates some situations where a store, it's like Bed Bath & Beyond. Right. They're brick-and-mortar stores.
Things you buy on the internet don't get the same sales tax as things you buy in a brick-and-mortar store.
Exactly. So it's creating a situation where a place that employs people like Bed Bath & Beyond, paying the highest corporate tax rate they can, employing people, in essence, if companies like Amazon and the rest don't get have to pay sales tax, it's kind of subsidizing the internet. And so certainly somewhere along the line, there must be fires where the fire department has to respond to internet companies. So how is it that we have them pay for what is their obligation for creating the public space that's required?
Does the mayor say that repealing all the Bush tax cuts would be good for New York specifically? He is the mayor of New York. New York usually pays more in taxes than it gets back from Washington.
Of course, it's huge. We've talked about that for years.
Would expiration of the Bush tax cuts, that is, higher taxes for everybody, mean more of New York subsidizing states like Georgia and South Carolina and Mississippi, which don't have as many rich people?
Well, now you're talking about more about, we've talked about it, for 20 years, Brian, it dates both of us, going back to the idea, Moynihan brought this up, Senator Moynihan. Historically, because this is about on the expenditure side of the federal budget, New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut are laggards. We get like 62 cents back for every dollar in terms of the money expended here by the federal government. I don't know if that dynamic would change. The big problem we have now, and Andrea Bernstein's Transportation Nation brings this up all the time, is in the East, our infrastructure is aging, and it's been around longer. In the old days, back in the 70s and 80s, the federal government stepped up, Brian, in a huge way, funding the majority of these big projects. Now the federal government, and this is what we're seeing now, really whoever takes office, whether it's Obama or Romney, we're going to see the federal government continue to step away from critical projects like water management, water treatment, sewer plants, and transportation, which is going to put more onus right here locally.
I want to play a clip of the mayor, one more clip of the mayor, on another national issue, the Trayvon Martin case. This certainly does have relevance to New York, as he will say here. The interstate gun trade affects violence here.
Sure.
This is the mayor last week, knowing that the National Rifle Association convention was getting underway in D.C.
This was a man with a history of violence, including arrests for assaulting a police officer and for domestic violence. I can just tell you that in New York, we would never allow such an individual to carry a gun, and neither would many other states.
And that's not all. He went on about this for a while. Here's a little more of the mayor in that April 11th news conference.
These laws have undermined the integrity of the justice system and done real harm to public safety. They have sown confusion in police departments about when to make arrests. They have made it more difficult for prosecutors to bring charges in cases of deadly violence.
So, Bob, why did Mayor Bloomberg wade into the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman, and Stand Your Ground law waters? New York has a Stand Your Ground bill in the legislature, but no one thinks it has a snowball's chance in Albany.
I think that this is he has just had a consistent record and been in a leadership position nationally, bringing together the mayor's coalition across the country dealing with this issue about gun violence, because there is a kind of bipartisan cowardice about this. I would say the Democrats, since Gore's defeat, where he lost critical states in the South, which some people believe was related to Democratic Democrats being perceived as being anti-gun. We really haven't seen much leadership out of Washington on this. And indeed, the undermining of the alcohol and tobacco, firearms, support for that, all kinds of things. I would commend the Chief newspaper, which I get every week, which is a good labor paper here in New York. You're probably familiar with it.
The Chief, it's about the city workforce,
yeah,
basically.
They had an amazing chart in there which showed in the states where Stand Your Ground has been put in place, a law that was lobbied for by the NRA, you saw dramatic increases in these cases of justified homicides. In Florida, 200% increase. Texas, a 70% increase. In Kentucky, a 1,000% increase. So this was quite logical that the mayor step in at this point, because this does have profound implications for the nation. And, you know, we're really seeing who is paying the price for this gun violence. It is, unfortunately, young men of color in just huge numbers. And for some reason, it's accepted as just that happens. But every day around the country, this is taking a toll.
And as far as I could tell, this has not broken out as an issue in the presidential race. Mitt Romney addressed the NRA convention personally the other day. He did not address Stand Your Ground one way or another. Talk about an elephant in the room. And where has been President Obama on the policy side of this? Everybody noticed when he said if he had a son, he would look like Trayvon Martin. But I don't think he's spoken out about Stand Your Ground.
No, I haven't seen anything about that yet either. And I think that's part of the fact that we're seeing all the candidates in such a guarded circumstance when it talks about this issue. This is really something that you just haven't seen anyone. And that's why it's really appropriate for the mayors of the country to step forward, because they're the ones, as the mayor so often says, have to go and speak to the victims and to, you know, the survivors of particularly police families. I mean, one of the things we are seeing nationally, we broke the story a while back, is a major increase in the death of police officers through handguns. I mean, that's something we're seeing. Even though crime is trending down, we're seeing this increase in officers getting killed in the line of duty, and illegal guns is driving this trend.
WNYC's Bob Henley, covering Mayor Bloomberg. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Did you see that New York Times op-ed that people are sharing a lot about the downside of cohabiting before marriage? Coming up after this break, we will talk to the writer, Meg Jay, about that and other themes from her new book, The Defining Decade, about life in your 20s. And we also have a text message survey going on right now about cohabiting, living together. If you want to take that survey, which we'll reflect the results of on the air, text LIVE to 30644. Text LIVE to 30644. And we'll talk about cohabiting and more with Meg Jay in just a minute.